From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. From tragedy, trauma. All over the country, people are absorbing the toll of two mass shootings that claimed the lives of at least 31 people last weekend. 22 of those deaths occurred in El Paso, in a shooting that authorities say targeted Latinos. Many are shaken by the conviction they are more broadly under attack for their heritage. Here's a smattering of local news interviews with Hispanics from around the country.
I'm concerned for my entire Hispanic community.
People are afraid to do things that normally no one would ever think to be afraid of, to go out in public in open spaces.
I've noticed that having people are a little edgier than they used to be.
I don't know whether I could go out of the house without some white supremacist coming up and attacking me. That's how I feel.
Rhetoric about invaders, separation of parents and children at the border, and now a mass murder of Hispanics. This hour, On Point, Latinos in Trump's America and the path ahead. Join us. For our Latino listeners, to what degree have you encountered hostility based on your heritage? How has that changed over the years? And how has the way in which you think about the U.S. or think about being American changed in these Trump years? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Austin, Texas, is Alexa Ura, the Texas Tribune's demographics reporter. She covers the way race collides with politics, with an emphasis on the state's Hispanic population. She reported from El Paso in the days after the shooting. Hello, Alexa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
From San Diego is Janet Murguia. She is president of Unidos U.S., the country's largest Latino civil rights organization. Janet, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And from Pasadena, California, Esmeralda Bermudez. She's a writer for the Los Angeles Times who has covered the Latino population for more than 15 years. Thanks so much for joining us, Esmeralda.
Thank you. Thank you for making space for this conversation.
Very important to us here. We were unanimous about that and talking about it in recent days. Alexa, I want to start with you. You've been in El Paso earlier this week. You're there in Austin, the capital of Texas. Talk to us a little bit about how folks in El Paso in particular, but Latinos throughout the state, are thinking about the way in which their identity is linked to the shootings that occurred.
You know, I think a lot of what you saw in El Paso over the weekend and throughout the week were these images that we've become almost too accustomed to after a mass shooting. But that was only half of it. And there was a real sense of in the air where people were really just trying to make sense of the senseless and this idea that they would have been attacked by the color of their skin. And I've seen it now back in Austin and talking to Hispanic leaders and community members throughout the state. There's this idea that, you know, are we actually safe? Is the rhetoric that was confined to this manifesto actually something that's shared pretty broadly? And, you know, I think in Texas, where there has been a long stream of anti-immigrant and anti-Hispanic rhetoric over the last couple of years, there's a real fear from people, and more so because they can't truly make sense of it. And in the absence of being able to make sense of it, there's some fear in the community.
Alexa Ura, to what degree would you feel that this is sort of how people felt prior to this attack, but sharpened to, you know, a knife point, sharpened to a crisis level by virtue of this vicious, murderous assault, or that this is transformative and this changes the degree to which people feel accepted, respected, American, you know, in addition to a variety of other identities?
You know, I think the shooting in El Paso was sort of the most violent manifestation of an idea and an ideology that's not limited to the shooter. And, you know, if you look at the rhetoric and the words he used in his manifesto, the idea of invasion, a lot of people have linked that to the president and the remarks he has made. But we have had state leaders here who have been using that same word years before Donald Trump was running for office. And so I think that the idea of whether this was limited to this incident is not something people believe. And when you, I think what the shooting more than anything did as well is to sort of throw down the facade that this was anti-immigrant rhetoric. You know, the shooter didn't stop and ask people whether they were born in the U.S. or whether they were immigrants. He targeted them based on the color of their skin. And I think that is is a real thing that we have to consider when we think about how people are regarded, how far this sort of rhetoric goes. And the idea that it's only limited to immigrants is not true. It expands mm-hmm. to anyone with brown skin at this point.
Mm-hmm. Janet Murguia, you're the head of Unidos U.S., which you know is the nation's largest Latino civil rights and advocacy organization. It used to go under the name National Council of La Raza. You wrote a piece earlier this week in the New York Times titled "The El Paso Shooting is the Violence Latinos Have Been Dreading." Why?
Well, the fact of the matter is this at for several years, we've dreaded this day. And I think it's because what we saw happen in El Paso really was not about immigration policy. It was about promoting the hate, fear, and division sown by President Trump. And in the past 3 years, Mr. Trump has systematically sought to paint a hateful portrait of Hispanics. You know, we've seen it and heard it over and over again since day one of his campaign. You know, when Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. That's when he announced his presidential candidacy. He referenced the fact that they're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists. He's referred to Latinos as animals and specifically likened immigration along the southern border to an invasion over and over again. And for us, to see even a U.S.-born, Indiana-born judge presiding over cases against Trump University as being biased because of his Mexican heritage by President Trump was just – there's so many references where he is placing out there this notion that somehow we don't belong, we're the other, and – in many minds of many Latinos and Hispanics, somehow that there's this effort underway right now to erase us from American life. And I know that sounds a little extreme, but when you look at the extreme nature of his rhetoric in particular that has in the past been on the extreme, that is now in the mainstream of conversation. The sad truth is that right now, many Latinos and Hispanics across this country don't feel that they can count on, you know, on our own government to have our backs. We feel like it's being used as a weapon against us. And we're seeing that in the advocacy and promotion of policies that are directly undermining Hispanics and Latinos today.
Sorry to interrupt. We'll be playing a little scattering of clips from Latinos from across the country throughout the hour. In this instance, Mauricio Calvo is executive director of Latino Memphis in Tennessee. He's also a candidate for the city council there. He said the impact of President Trump's rhetoric was notable well before last weekend's shooting.
He is attacking our communities, and specifically the Hispanic community, from day one when he announced his candidacy. I mean, now we have these type of actions where somebody says, well, I want to do something. I might do something that's going to drive for a number of hours and start shooting people. And this is going to continue to happen.
Esmeralda Bermudez, I want to get at one of the questions Janet raised, which was the president's rhetoric and how that influences what we think of existing all around us right now. I mean, I'm originally from California. I remember in the 90s, Governor Pete Wilson taking a tack before running for president himself, unsuccessfully, really going hard on the question of illegal immigration and taking a tough tone against Latinos there. Surely President Trump is not the only national politician to sound that chord over the years, over the decades in this country. How fair is it to ascribe current circumstances to the president's rhetoric as opposed to, you know, what's swimming around us more generally?
Well, you know, I think I go by what I hear from people. My role is to put my ear as close to the ground as possible here in L.A. Mm-hmm. It's what I've been doing for 11 years for the paper. And on Sunday after the shooting, we fanned out about half dozen Latino reporters and just spoke to a lot of Latinos. And Trump was on everybody's mouths. So it's definitely you know, there's no way of separating him from the conversation. But I think absolutely here in California, as you mentioned, dating back to the repatriation days to back in the 50s, there was at some point Operation Wetback, which sent back, I believe, about a million Mexicans.
The Eisenhower years, yeah.
Right. There's also, as you mentioned, Proposition 187, the Minutemen protests, you know, Sheriff Joe Arpaio. I mean, it's come in waves. And I think what I've heard from people is that it's also felt peripheral. It's even from, you know, one of the we spoke to a Republican Party consultant, Mike Madrid, he told us that this always felt like this was just kind of lurking in the darkest corners, and it would be called out. And now, you know, it feels like it's very much taken central stage. And mm-hmm. and it's very consistent and methodical attacks, ammunition that's coming straight from the mouth of the president. So there's no way to kind of separate him from that. And, you know, one of the first people that I spoke to on Sunday was Pablo Alvarado, who is the executive director of the National Day Labor Organizing Network. And Pablo is someone who's been in the trenches for 30 years with one of the most vulnerable populations, day laborers nationwide. And he's seen all kinds of things. He's lived through most of these things that we just talked about. And the first thing he said on the phone, you know, sounding very, you know, quite frustrated, he said, you know, I feel like this is the first time that our adversaries have truly declared war against our immigrant community.
Wow. Strong words there. We're talking with two Latina journalists and a leading Latina activist about life today for American Hispanics. You can join our conversations. I'd especially like to hear from our Latino listeners. How's your own community been affected by this murderous assault in El Paso? How's your sense of being Latino in America shifted over recent years? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing the repercussions of last week's shooting in El Paso on Latino communities across the country. You can join our conversation. If you're Latino in America, tell us how this past week has affected you. If you're Hispanic and voted for Trump, we'd very much like to hear from you as well. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Alexa Ura is the Texas Tribune's demographics reporter. She reported from El Paso in the days after the shooting. Janet Murguia is president of Unidos U.S., the country's largest Latino civil rights organization. And Esmeralda Bermudez is a writer for the Los Angeles Times. She's been covering issues affecting Latinos for more than 15 years. I'd like to play a brief clip from a resident of East Los Angeles. His name is Hervé Viega. He spoke with local news station KABC earlier this week.
My family's from Chihuahua, Mexico, so for me to hear such tragic news, it breaks my heart knowing that there's people out there, people in my Hispanic community, that are still suffering through this, you know, this white supremacy and just gun violence in general. It doesn't stop.
I want to take some of your calls now to share with our listeners as well as our guests. I'd like to first go to Boston, Massachusetts, where Sonia's calling in. For those of our listeners who are Latino who wish to do so, if you might say, you know, where your family is from, where your heritage traces back to, because we want to perhaps reflect the multiplicity of the Latin experience. Sonia, go ahead.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for taking my call. My mother's from Colombia, and my father was from El Salvador. They met in Boston, where I was born and raised. And after this week, after the shooting, it was like a feeling of otherness resurfaced in me, and the otherness is something that I've always been struggling with my entire life. So having grown up straddling two cultures, you know, being Latina at home, speaking Spanish, you know, making our food, following our traditions, and then on the other hand, being American and wanting to go to the mall and, you know, worried about my grades and going to college. So there was always this sense that I didn't know exactly where I belonged. So among the white community, they were like, oh, you're Hispanic, you're other. And then when I would go and visit my family in Colombia, they'd be like, well, you're American, you're not really Colombian, so you're other. And now this shooting has happened, and now this sense of otherness is just even more ramped up because it feels like we're being targeted. You know, there's a feeling of dread, a feeling of fear, definitely anger that, you know, that as Latinos, we're being singled out and we're being basically hunted down. You know, and I remember, you know, somebody saying, oh, well, you know, this happened along the border. And I'm like, you know, the shooter didn't stop and ask, are you Mexican? Are you Guatemalan? Are you Colombian? He shot at everybody. So they're coming for all of us. And it's something that's very scary that, you know, I worry about myself, yes, but I also worry about my daughter. I worry about my mother and, you know, and all my friends, because now it sort of feels like we're walking around with targets on our backs.
Thank you, David, for sharing your thoughts and concerns. Please hop in.
Yeah, David, what Sonia is saying is really reflected nationally. You know, as myself, as a Latina born in Kansas, I'm often told to go back to where I came from. And I think people would smile or be upset if they knew they were sending me home to Kansas. But recently at Unidos US, we conducted—
And to remind listeners, you're the head of this major national Latino civil rights organization.
Sure, and we're actually based in Washington, D.C. And we recently conducted a poll and put out those results. And Latino voters, 78% responded being frustrated with how President Trump and his allies treat immigrants and Latinos and worry it will get worse if Trump is reelected. And three quarters of those voters made it really clear that they want candidates who value diversity and will work to unite the country. I mean, right now we're feeling as a community under attack. And there's a reason behind that. And this poll was done before El Paso. I can only imagine now, post El Paso, how our community feels under assault.
You know, Jana, I was going to actually ask you a bit about that, because it was interesting. In your poll, it showed that there was some fluidity. That is, that both parties seemed to not quite do it for a lot of Latino voters, that there would be some openness, but that there was a strong lean Democratic and there was real grave concern, as you said, about the president. You're saying at this point that poll hasn't factored into his handling to this, what's seen as, from what you're describing, as a major crisis among Latinos.
There's no question about it. And I think this sense that Trump has been using a strategy that really dehumanizes Latinos with hateful rhetoric. It strips away federal protections that safeguard our rights. And this promotion of policies that marginalize our families and stoke fear, division, and violence is palpable and it's real. And I think it's been made only worse by what we're seeing post El Paso now. But this was all evident and resonant before El Paso.
Mm-hmm. It was Alexa.
You know, I wanted to return.
Please go hop in.
Hi. This is Esmeralda.
Esmeralda, yes.
So, you know, I wanted to return to this topic of otherness, because in these last couple of days, it's been really fascinating to me. I'm, you know, was born in El Salvador. I'm a part of the immigrant generation. I came when I was 5 years old. And I think, you know, there's always common themes, I think, that you find in the Latino community, themes of surrendering, right, or erasing, a feeling of giving up language or maybe your home country, or this feeling of your identity slipping away because you have also a pressure of having to prove yourself. Are you American enough? Are you hardworking enough? Are you smart enough? And also fighting to make space, having to have your voice heard, having to say, hey, you know, every part of me counts in this country. And, you know, I think a lot of times you think of those themes and maybe some folks associate that to newer immigrants like myself or people who are maybe in the first or second generation. These last couple of days, we've been working with a colleague, Paloma Esquivel, to actually speak with Latinos who have been in the country anywhere between 100 to up to 400 years. And I wanted to share with you an experience of one woman, Arlinda Valencia in Texas, whose family dates back to the 1600s. Her great-grandfather was killed by a white lynch mob 101 years ago. And in her younger years with her husband, you know, they fought a lot of discrimination as teachers. They ended up moving to El Paso because they found this place was a refuge. When the Walmart shooting happened, she had no clue about Manifesto. She had not heard that it was race related. She turned to her husband and she said, "It's here. They've come to kill the Mexicans." She knew it in her heart that this was something that the target had been hit against Latinos. And the thing that she was left with that she told my colleague Paloma was, here we are 101 years later having to deal with the same thing. And it's fascinating, you know, it's these feelings of not belonging, of questioning identity, of asking. Another person I spoke to said, is finding herself saying, well, I have pretty light skin, so maybe I'm passable. Maybe, you know, I'm feeling okay. I don't speak Spanish, so maybe I'm okay. So very deep questions that a lot of Latinos are having to ask themselves. And it doesn't have to do with whether you just came out of a detention center or you just crossed the border. You could have been here before this soil was American soil, and you're still fighting these things.
And Esmeralda, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I wanted to build on what Esmeralda was saying, because I think...
Alexa, you know, Urash, please.
There's often an oversimplification of what the Latino community is like. And here in Texas, a vast, vast majority of the 11.4 million Latinos living here were born in the United States. And I think when you think of Texas's geography, you know, you have these border communities like El Paso and Laredo, where I grew up, that are predominantly Hispanic, where everyone might speak Spanish, where no one questions if you're speaking Spanish while walking down the street. You know, but there are also millions of Latinos living in places like Houston and Dallas, and there are folks whose family just arrived yesterday, and there are folks who have been here for five or six generations. And I think oftentimes we also think of the Hispanic community on these oversimplified terms. And we have to sort of accept and also be open to the idea that those experiences are going to be different, and that, you know, like the individual that Esmeralda mentioned, you know, there's a long history of discrimination in Texas, and some people carry that with them. Other people are facing sort of more recent expressions of that discrimination and that racism. I think the overall takeaway is that it's not limited by geography. It's not limited by whether you were born here or not. And, you know, often it comes down to very often the color of someone's skin. And that tends to oversimplify our experiences and our identities, when really there's so much diversity even within the Latino community.
The onus I think really falls, it's hard to hold yourself accountable, but it really falls as a journalist, I think, on journalists to not portray the Latino community as this big blob.
Right, monochromatic somehow.
Exactly. And I think a lot of that really comes down to, you're hearing that nuance in all of our voices right now, comes down to having more Latinos in newsrooms, mm-hmm. To be out in the community on a day-to-day basis, not just when massacres happen, but on a day-to-day basis, really pulling on those threads, on those layers, so that people understand all these different, you know, points. And unfortunately, in this massacre, in this moment in time, one of the darkest hours for Latinos, at least in the first 72 hours of the shooting, I was very, very disappointed to see the level of coverage that we were getting on front pages across the country. There was a lot of, you know, talk about whether things that, you know, President Trump was saying, or is this a mental, you know, health issue? Is this video games? Obviously, gun control which is very important. But the matter of the fact is, in the front page in a lot of Latinos' minds that day was, this is the deadliest hate crime against Latinos that has happened in decades. Mm-hmm. And you didn't really see those headlines nationwide.
Mm-hmm. I want to take a couple of quick calls now. First, from Portland, Maine. Roberto, thanks for joining us.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Doing well. Tell us your thoughts, sir.
Well, I'm 62 years old. I've been dealing with prejudice all my life. My parents are Puerto Rican. I was born in California. Mm-hmm. Raised in New Jersey, and nothing's changed. The only thing that's happened is Trump has emboldened many people to start speaking their minds. So mm-hmm. really, it's more a matter of getting people to change their minds and not look at people who are brown as different. You know, I married a white woman, and I have one son who's dark like me and one son who's blonde. And I worry about the one who's dark like me because I dealt with a lot of prejudice over the years. I mean, mostly at work, at school. I mean, I was beaten up. I learned how to learn how to fight at an early age. It's sad. Nothing's really changed as far as I'm concerned. We need to change people's minds and hearts about difference and being more inclusive. Because until we do that, all the rules about guns, it doesn't really matter. You know, hurt is hurt. Whether somebody uses their tongue or a gun or a knife, you know, I'll be honest with you, the worst is the tongue. You know, and then employers treating you differently because, you know, I rose to upper management, put myself through college, and I always got paid less than the others, even though I worked harder and deserved more. But because of my color, I got less. So
the American success story, it sounds like, Roberto, and yet you're still the recipient of the American legacy of racism.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's sad. So I you know, it's a complicated issue though, you know, and I have many friends who are Latino of different cultures and all face the same problems because of the color of their skin.
Okay. Thank you for this, Roberto. Appreciate it. Want to also take a call from Richmond, Virginia. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you. I'd just like to say that it is a racism problem. And I get racism from all angles. I get the white people are mad at the black people. The black people are mad at the white people. The brown people are mad at the white and the black people. It's when communities start setting themselves up as our community, well, right away, they're isolating them from everybody else.
And are you, Jim, are you yourself Latino, Jim?
I'm Mexican-American. My mother was Spanish and my father was white.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been here for three generations. And yet I see these people come across the border and they bring their children and they're breaking the law when they do it. And then they complain when they get here and their children are taken away from them or something happens with their children when they go back to their home country, they're deported. And yet they put their children in that place and then they want to say, oh, y'all are doing this to us. What about personal responsibility? If you make these decisions to break the law, then you should expect the results.
Okay, Jim, thank you for that. So let's turn that to Janet Mugia. You know, why don't you handle both the question that he raised about people coming across the border and also the question Roberto alluded to, which it's in his perspective, the president may have emboldened people to speak their minds more, but that it's not any different than people would have thought without him.
Well, I think it's just important to reset a little bit on those statistics about the Latino community, the Hispanic community. Mm-hmm. There are 50 million Hispanics in the United States. 80% of those Hispanics are United States citizens. And under the age of 18, that number jumps to 93%. One out of every four American children is Hispanic. So I want to be clear that as, you know, President Trump and some would have us focus uniquely on immigrants, I think this notion that this is about color and the fact that we are a diverse country and that that diversity should be viewed as a strength. But I think that Roberto is tapping into something, obviously, that we're all aware of, that we've had a history and a legacy in this country of having to confront that sense of discrimination and racism and bigotry based on color. And what I worry and what I see is that what we saw Saturday in El Paso is directly connected to the continuing hate-driven rhetoric and policies coming out of the White House. You know, violence is a terrifying but not unexpected outcome when our nation's leader tries to normalize hate. And so I think it's a confluence of things happening here that are creating this sort of toxic mix of how people are seeing our community and culminating in now violence. But a lot of that is related to the fact that we are people of color in this country, and as a country, we still need to reconcile how we are going to engage and help one another.
We're discussing the status of Latinos in the U.S. in the wake of last week's mass shooting in El Paso. You can join our conversation. For our Latino listeners, what issues are most important to your families? How has the current climate affected the way you vote? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie. And I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics, words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're discussing the Latino experience in the U.S. following last weekend's mass murder in El Paso, the deadliest attack targeting Hispanics in recent American history and taking place in a city that is 80% Latino. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Alexa Ura is the Texas Tribune's demographics reporter. She reported from El Paso in the days after the shooting. Janet Murguia is the president of Unidos U.S., the country's largest Latino civil rights organization. And Esmeralda Bermudez is a writer for the Los Angeles Times covering the Latino population for more than 15 years. Esmeralda, I want to play for you a clip from a man named Victor Irizarry. He's a resident of Erie, Pennsylvania for more than 20 years. And on Monday, he expressed his concerns to the local station there, WICU.
Not long ago, I was at a gas station in Ohio. And there was a car parked in front of where I should have been getting gas. And she turned around and said to me, why don't you go back where you came from?
Esmeralda, you know, your readers have benefited from your vivid reporting in the Los Angeles Times for many years about subjects closely related to what we're talking about today, right? But I've also read an interview in which you talked about your own experiences, your own experience with your own daughter, and the notion of what it meant to be American versus somehow, I guess, to other people, what it meant to be Latino. Talk to me about what language has meant for you and for your daughter as you raise your child in Los Angeles there.
Well, about a year ago, last spring, I was at a playground at a park, and I was everywhere I go, I only speak Spanish to my daughter, outside or inside my house. I've never spoken to her in English on purpose, mm-hmm. because we are raising trilingual kids. They speak English, Spanish, Armenian, and she's also learning French. But this woman on the playground didn't know any of this. She just heard the Spanish, and it obviously disturbed her, and so she scolded me. She said, that I need to speak English and that I'm basically ruining my daughter. What am I doing to my daughter by speaking Spanish to her? And I told her she's actually trilingual. And she said, well, how well can she speak any of those languages anyway, speaking that many languages? So, you know, there was just this huge fault line between her understanding and my understanding. And in that moment, I really felt, As empowered as I felt by the truth of my life and the gifts that I've been given by my daughter, I also felt very cut down instantly. As a 38-year-old professional, I instantly felt like the 7-year-old getting picked on, being called a beaner, a wetback back in second grade. And it was an emotional roller coaster ride. that then went viral. And so on Twitter, actually. And so, but, you know, language to me in our lives has been one of the greatest gifts. It's holding on to so much of our histories, our you know, the poetry, the music, Juan Gabriel, Vicente Fernandez. I mean, all this beauty that lies in our culture, I cannot let that go. And neither can my husband let his Armenian side go. Mm-hmm. And so it really, a year and a half later, I find myself actually being grateful to that woman of all strange things to say, because she really reminded me that what I'm doing is the best, the road that I'm on is the best road to continue walking down. And it really gave me just a lot of insight, not just about myself, but also people who can't speak up like the way that I speak up. Maybe people who can't, you know, don't speak four languages, who might hardly even speak English, as I once upon a time, you know, couldn't speak English. So it's definitely, I think it's come, it's, there's a lot of positivity that grew out of that very dark moment.
Mm-hmm. I want to take some calls now. We've got people rolling in to join us. Nora is calling from Dedham, Massachusetts. Nora, thanks for listening. Thanks for your call.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. You know, definitely the words are mightier than the sword. And I think that it's not just words that are being spoken now, but words that are in the history books. And I think that people, one way of changing people's minds, our mind, is by really going deep into our history, the history of a nation and the history, world history. So I, if you look back, of course, and I know that part of it was already commented about how it's been in waves, but this, so many of the states that, there are several states that belong now to the United States that were from, that belonged to Mexico and originally. And then you could say originally they were from Spain. And then originally you could say, well, they were really from the natives who lived in on the soil.
All true.
The native people. And so I think people really, we really need to go back into our into history and look into that. And mm-hmm. I hear, oh, I'm Hispanic, I'm Latina, which, by the way, I am. I'm an American. Wait a second. I'm a U.S. citizen because Hispanic implies American, because America is from Canada to Chile, from the southmost point. So we are all Americans, and that's something that was. I think it's subliminal, but it's inbred that America is of the United States only. No, the United States is a country. It's a nation. America is a continent. And I am Hispanic because I speak Spanish, but I'm Latin because Spanish is from the Latin root. So it's all, and I consider myself white because I'm not dark skinned. And so what is all these names? We're folks. We're people. And definitely go back into history to see that we've all gone through the same path. There have been invasions from countries for very selfish reasons, such as when Theodore Roosevelt, who I admire in many ways, but he did what he did to Panama, to Colombia, mm-hmm. and the Panama mm-hmm. because of the Panama Canal, et cetera, et cetera. So I think history is something, history is civic, and morals have to be inbred from the moment we're born.
Okay, thank you for that, Nora. A call for a deep reflection and understanding of history. I want to take a couple more quick calls before we turn to our thoughtful guest that we have here today. Jean-Pierre is calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Thanks for joining us.
Hi.
Hi.
I just have a question, and I'll take it off the air.
Okay.
What are we doing for the conservative Latinos? Are we reaching out to them and find out why they're still supporting this party when we find this rhetoric?
And before you go off the air, Jean-Pierre, can you help define for us who's the we that you're thinking about here in terms of reaching out to conservative Latinos?
I'm Colombian. I was mm-hmm. born in South America, Colombia. Mm-hmm. And I've been here in the U.S. since 78. And I see how, you know, the mixture of just two parties going on. And I wish there was a third party or fourth party or sixth party like Germany is. But mm-hmm. it's United States of America is a title. It's not a name. It just says U.S., just like the USSR was. I'm just trying to figure out what is the organization in Washington, D.C. doing about these conservatives who are following this party, and are they talking to them and trying to find out why they keep voting like this?
All right. Well, let me toss that to a couple of our guests. Thanks for calling in. Janet Murguia, you are the head of Unidos U.S.
Sure.
There are, you know, plenty of conservative Latinos in this country, and Trump has, call it, I don't know, 20-25%, I guess, of the Latino vote last time. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of schisms and divides among different subsections of the Latino vote. Tell us how it breaks out and how you think about it, given your activist role.
Well, I actually look at this most recent poll that we put out earlier this week, and I think Jean-Pierre may be referring to one of the aspects of that poll, which, again, showed overwhelming support from Latino voters for a candidate who pledges to restore our American values, specifically a candidate who remembers that diversity is our nation's strength and who will work to unite all Americans. The other aspect that we saw in this was that Latino voters are also pragmatic, solution-focused, and would rather have elected officials work in a bipartisan manner than have them dig in on partisan issues. And that gives me hope. I believe that the vast majority of our fellow Americans want this as well and reject the fear, hate, division, and violence that has now marred our country, and certainly reject the rhetoric we've been seeing coming out of the White House. And mm-hmm. I do believe that both parties need to be thinking very clearly about what they're doing now and how that will affect their ability to garner support. You know, at our conference, which was hosted here in San Diego recently, we had five of the Democratic candidates for the nomination of the party here.
For president.
Yes, that's correct. And, mm-hmm. You know, our community is eager to hear from all the candidates what they will do along these lines, because as we've seen, they really feel strongly, our Latino voters feel strongly about someone who will come in and unite as opposed to divide. And they're not seeing that in the current resident of the White House. As I mentioned before, they're seeing that and much worse. They're seeing the attacks relentless on our community. And so there is an opportunity for a candidate to emerge, certainly in the Democratic Party, to win over Democratic Latino voters, or to win over Latino voters in particular. And I'll just mention that it was 25 years ago when Proposition 187, that's been referenced earlier here today, in California was passed by Governor Pete Wilson. But mm-hmm. when you look back at that now, it is something that I think we can fairly say that has been, at the time was a devastating blow. But our community has really fought back, organized, and voted, and, you know, forever changed the political landscape of California. And for the Republican Party, they need to look at what was the full result of what happened with a bill and a law like Proposition 187, and what has that meant for their party? I mean, they are essentially decimated as a party here. And mm-hmm. I think that there are lessons to be learned from Prop 187 and from seeing the rise of Joe Arpaio and SB 1070 in Arizona. There's been a categorical rejection of those types of anti-immigrant, anti-Latino policies and all the rhetoric that goes with them. And it has had a devastating and adverse effect on the Republican Party. There's a lesson to be learned here today, but we're still not seeing any evidence that that lesson has been learned.
And Alexa Ura, is that how consistent is that with what you've seen and heard in Texas in terms of, you know, that's a much more red state than the blue, currently blue state of California, right? But,
sure.
You know, in terms of Latino voters and Latino residents there, how consistent is that with what you've seen?
You know, I think in the same way that we were talking about differences in identity and experiences among the Hispanic community, you know, there are a range of political views as well. Hispanics in Texas tend to lean pretty heavily toward the Democrats. But of course, they're also said to be much more conservative than Hispanics in other parts of the country. And, you know, I think back to 2016, I was talking to voters in Harris County, which is home to Houston. And there was a couple, they were immigrants from Venezuela and they were Republicans. And as they were leaving the voting booth, they said, you know, we're Republicans, we support this party, but we wish Trump would stop talking. And I think, you know, they're not alone in that when you think about some of these communities that are growing, that are changing, where politics stands today might be different than where it stood 20 years ago, especially among the Republican Party. But I think in the aftermath of El Paso, what I've heard so far from Hispanic leaders here is that the question now becomes, what are state leaders, and in our case, Republican leaders, willing to do to protect Latinos? And, you know, is it putting aside, whether it's through gun violence reform and or more specifically talking about domestic terrorism and white supremacy in ways we have not seen them talk about before. Mm-hmm. I think that's the question on people's minds. And, you know, ahead of the next election, it's something that a lot of Hispanic organizers are thinking about and now sort of really considering how to make that a part of their organizing efforts.
I want to very quickly get a last call in from Madison, Wisconsin. Ron, thanks for listening. What's your thoughts?
Okay, a little background first. I'm a baby boomer, lifelong Republican, not a Trumpian. My family's been here since the 1600s.
Uh-huh.
Pro-immigration, pro-gun control, even though I own a gun. I used to live in El Paso. Mm-hmm. I really have sympathy here for this thing. Everything I've heard today, I've actually agreed with. I have worked with migrants, most of whom are Hispanics, the great people. I don't understand why people can't see that.
All right. Well, let me thank you so much for your call, Ron. I do want to ask very briefly, Esmeralda, you know, these something played out today, or this week rather, with the ICE raids on the processing plant in Mississippi. And obviously there's been the border control efforts where parents and kids have been separated. Is it your sense that more conservative or Republican Latino voters are having their ties to the party and the movement tested by that, or are they locked in through other issues?
I think this moment, El Paso is testing Latinos in many, many ways, regardless of, you know, where you lean with your party. The feeling is that, you know, a lot of times you've considered this to be an attack on immigrants. And after El Paso, it's felt like this is really about all Latinos. So regardless of where you come from and what how you plan to vote.
You've been hearing the words there of Esmeralda Bermudez. She's writer for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks, Esmeralda, for being with us today.
Thank you.
We've also heard from Janet Murguia. She's president of Unidos U.S., the country's largest Latino civil rights civil organization. Thanks, Janet.
Thank you.
And we've heard from Alexa Ura, the Texas Tribune's demographics and politics reporter. Great to have you with us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.